Welcome to Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Our website is econtalk.org, where you can subscribe, comment on this podcast, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives, where you can listen to every episode we've ever done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is January 8th, 2020, and my guest is economist, author, and investor Richard Robb. He is CEO of Christofferson, Robb & Company, a New York and London-based fund management company that invests in risk-sharing transactions with European banks. He is also a professor of professional practice at Columbia School of International and Public Affairs, and he holds a PhD in economics, as do I, from the University of Chicago. He's the author of Willful, How We Choose What to Do, which is the topic of today's conversation. Richard, welcome to Econ Talk.
Great to be here, Russ.
How do we choose what to do? Your book is a really beautiful, fascinating, deep dive into what motivates us, what explains our behavior, and you contrast what you call purposeful behavior with behavior that's for itself. Talk about that distinction.
Yeah. Purposeful behavior encompasses what we learned back at University of Chicago, what we believed and what we both believe to varying degrees still to this day. And purposeful choice, as I define it, are the types of choices we make when we can compare one thing to another, decide which we like more. We know enough about the world that maybe not have perfect certainty, but we know enough to know which options we would rank higher than the others. We have resources at our disposal, and then we seek to choose what's best. We act with a purpose in that sense. So life is a big project to try to satisfy our desires as best I can, the best we can, with the information and resources at hand. I divide purposeful choice into two pieces. One is good old-fashioned rational choice, where we basically do the best we can with what we've got. And the other is behavioral economics, where we fall victim to some sort of cognitive bias and systematically choose in ways that fail to gratify us and fail to satisfy our desires. So I put those two together in one branch, where rational choice. In both cases, we act in a. We have desires, we are a bit robotic, and in the case of behavioral bias, the robots are just poorly programmed. And maybe
nice
we
distinction.
Yeah, and maybe we can learn about it. The behavioral economists will tell us, you know, not to overvalue things we already own, not to be overconfident in our information, because that won't get us what we want, which is more. Everything can be compared to everything in the purposeful choice realm. You can always trade this for that at some rate of exchange. So if you fall victim to a bias, you're not getting what's best. And if you should change your ways. I believe, maybe not as strongly as I used to believe, but that's a powerful way to understand human behavior in markets, in individuals. But I don't think it's the whole story. Sometimes we act just because. That it's not because it's better than this or that. It's not. We're not behaving irrationally. We're not making a mistake. But neither can we say this is best. I argue in the book that life is twofold. That sometimes it's purposeful. Sometimes it's for itself. And sometimes actions are self-justifying.
So in the self-justifying category, you know, listeners are familiar with some of the examples I've used in the past, and maybe you and I have talked about them off the air in this program, for this program. But you know, I use the example often of the dance floor, where, yes, you could understand my behavior on a dance floor with a dance partner as I'm going to show off and I want to maximize how good I look on the dance floor. And I would argue that's not what most people actually do. They might have an impulse to do that, but often we act with what Adam Smith called propriety, prudence, with the norms of our society, which is that when you're on the dance floor, the thing you're really trying to do is maybe enhance how your partner looks, or you might be trying to make sure you don't bump into other people. There's a set of norms and rules, And when you're out there, you're not thinking, how could I look even better? You're just focused on doing what we might call the right thing, the satisfying thing, the thing you think you're supposed to do, the proper thing. But you're also, so that's it. That's in your idea, right. But there's more to it than that.
Yeah, you know, dance is a good metaphor for the for itself realm of behavior, where we're lost in, at moments, you're lost in the dance. I'm not a professional dancer. I gather you're not either, and so at the moment when I can occasional moment where I can be lost in dancing with my wife, it's not this much better than that other dance. It just can, and I'm not trying to, should I stop dancing so I could get some other thing that might be better?
And the model says you should stop just when the next second of dancing isn't as good as the first second of something else. That's the way economists are trained.
Exactly. But you're not in a state where you reevaluate. Time doesn't stop and then decide what's going to be best. And then, well, should I keep dancing? Okay, well, I'm already doing it. I'm already on the floor. It's giving me a certain amount of enjoyment. So, yeah, I'll keep doing it another moment. And then we'll start time back up again. And I'll do it for another little bit. And who knows? Maybe I'll stay out here for a long time because it's the best marginal use of my time. For a certain sphere of our behavior, sport or dance is a better analogy. I use sport. I contrast homo economist to homo ludens, which is an anthropologist referred to the sporting human
at play,
and but I could have used dancing just as easily.
Well, I like your example, and you could tell us a little about it for the listeners of the, you're playing a pickup football game, a touch football game, and in many ways you're not acting like an economist. Why not? Or the way an economist might think of you.
It's a true story, as all the stories in the book are. I was walking through Central Park on my way home, and people were playing football, American football for your international viewers, and I joined the game. And during the game, I really wanted to win, and I was never going to see these people again. There's no prize for winning. Still caught up. I use that example in the book because it's a pure example of playing a game where there's no status because I'll never see them again.
No monetary stakes.
No monetary stakes. Yeah, and look, there is a price. There is a price for everything. I mean, I imagine if somebody came, some sort of strange top-headed benefactor wandered up and offered me $1 million to stop playing, I would take $1 million. I would take a lot less. So I'm not completely lost in the moment, but for all practical purposes, I am, because people like that don't exist in the real world. So the fact that some thought experiment could disrupt me from my sport or play, I don't think overturns the observation that in much of everyday life, sporting is a better analogy to optimizing, particularly when it comes to how we allocate ourselves through time.
Yeah, it's a great point. And obviously, economists could wax poetic about how much money it might take to get you to quit, and et cetera. But I think it's fascinating to me, that particular example, because I'm a sports fan. I'm thinking about Tom Brady this year, who's 42, and he ended the season with a pick six, which is a bad outcome for non-football fans. And he's got a lot of money, and he can make a lot of money outside of football. And football's really dangerous. You can hurt yourself really badly. He has once. I'm sure he hurts every week, but he once ripped up his knee and was out for a year. And you could argue it's irrational that he wants to keep playing. And you could subtly say, "Oh no, it's not for the money. It's for the rush and the thrill of he'll miss that." And so it is still optimizing and rational, but I don't think that's capturing fully what's going on, as you point out.
No, and I think when this dawned on me in my own life, I don't want to compare myself to Tom
You're
Brady.
A lot like Tom Brady. Yeah, you're 6'5", right?
Okay, there's no camera here. Yeah. The when I tell the story in the book, when I worked for a Japanese bank for a decade, I loved the bank. I loved working there. And then it merged with two other Japanese banks, and I had to leave. There was no place for me in the merged bank. So I was still more caught up in the Chicago school at that time, although I was starting to wonder around the edges about a lot of things we had been taught, and I believe, and I still do. So when the bank came to an end, I was unemployed. So I thought, okay, I've been working as a banker for a while. I don't have to get another job right away. And I'll enjoy leisure, because those are the inputs into the utility function, goods and leisure, consumption and leisure into the household. And I'll be able
That's
to...
That's the way we were taught.
The way we were taught, yeah.
And you want to maximize trading off leisure versus work,
right.
And work you need for the goods, and do you have a constraint of income, blah, blah,
so,
blah.
Yeah, so I have goods, and I have leisure, so this should be ecstasy. And it wasn't. Say in the book that, I would get up in the morning, make breakfast for my children, send them off to school, go run around the reservoir in Manhattan, read the New York Times. Now it's 9 o'clock.
It's a perfect day so far.
Yeah. What happens next is the day stretches out. Now what? So maybe I lacked imagination. Maybe I should have filled this full of all sorts of creative activities, but there weren't enough. And then the weekdays start blending in with the weekends, and then you're out of the game when you talk to other people. And I was 40 years old at the time, and I was going nuts. And that lasted for about 6 months. And then I went to teach at Columbia, and that turned into a full-time job, and started up the fund with my partners. And that's full-time job. They're both still full-time jobs. I'm much happier having two jobs than I was when I had none.
So you're really lucky, because if it had happened more recently, you'd have spent all day watching YouTube and you'd have been satisfied with that, perhaps, and the world would have missed out on your teaching and your investing. But to take the point more seriously, one of the themes of your book is that a lot of what we crave is not more stuff. It's subtler values. We talk about a lot on the program in terms of Adam Smith's theory of moral sentiments. We want to be loved. We want to be respected. We want to be praised. We want to matter. We want people to care about us. We want people to think about us when we walk in the room and say, I wonder what that person's about.
And we also want to overcome challenges.
That was the thing I was going to add.
That are authentic.
So talk about the challenges and bring in some Nietzsche into that, because I know that your reading of Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche, is part of what helped you think about these issues.
Yeah. That we want to find out about ourselves, test our skills, pit them against authentic challenges that come up in the course of our lives, and a big part of our meaning. And I think that on the job, that what people derive from work is a team sport. Even though, as you point out, my strong physical resemblance to Tom Brady, I've passed the day where I can be an NFL quarterback. So all I've got for a team sport is work. Yeah. So our colleagues, fighting against rival firms, trying out our ideas in the market to see if this is going to work in practice as it works in theory, failing sometimes and dusting ourselves off and trying again. All that is, it's what we do. And I'm privileged to be able to do this as an investor. I think all sorts of jobs at all different levels present challenges that people getting to work and being organized and working in the factory and working in agriculture. I think all that is people experience it as authentic contributions to society and obstacles that come up, and it's and people take pride in it. And to say that one is better than another, I think is a big mistake. And I think it applies, you know, and I think when that work has two characters and confusing, and they're blended together, that it's partly the goods that we need to sustain ourselves, but it's partly a sport.
I think the sport part's really interesting. Obviously, I think mistakenly, a lot of people think that the sport of business is, quote, keeping score with money. There is some of that, obviously, and in certain circles, that's important. There's status issues in terms of what your apartment's like and your car and your watch and all that. But it's so much more than that. It's that overcoming of challenges, and it's the competitive part, not who racks up the most necessarily monetary points, but prestige points, style points. There's a whole bunch of different scorecards out there that matter.
Yeah, and just there are even moments where you just don't keep score, where there's no way to keep score. There are no points that you can assign to something. How about that? I just wore myself out today, and what I did worked, or maybe it will work. We'll find out in time, but it was, you know, I did what I could.
And my dad's been in the hospital recently, and I went down to visit him, and I was just blown away by the nurses in that hospital. And listeners know that I've got some issues with hospital pricing, and we're going to be talking about that going forward more and more, I think, on this program, at least from time to time. But what was powerful about that is that, you know, nursing is it's an incredibly difficult job, and it's full of surprises. It's full of challenges, and I think that makes it, quote, fun. They're not the challenges of Tetris or Fortnite, but there are challenges. And I asked one of the nurses, I said, how do you do this? You know, this is at 3 a.m. when he's taking my dad's, who knows what he was doing, some vital sign or giving him insulin or whatever it was. And he looked at me and as if it was matter of fact, he just said, well, it's really rewarding. And obviously that's a cliche that people go into certain things because they're rewarding, but what we might call the helping professions, but it's more than what I think people think about, which is they usually think, well, it's rewarding to help people stay alive, get out of the hospital, get better. It's also rewarding just to face that daily challenge.
For sure. You know, nursing is a noble profession on its face, but I think it's important to realize, you know, my students are often directed towards impact investing and the like, and they want to
social responsibility.
And the kind of thing, and I try to calm them down to say that, you know, to try to divide up the world into good and evil, the phrase of giving back is something that really irritates me every time I hear it, because when you're doing your work and you're producing for our common good, you're not taking and then doing good acts to restore it somehow to benefit humankind. But that, you know, we're sitting in these chairs. Somebody had to make the chairs. Somebody had to deliver the chairs up to your office so we can talk about nurses. And, you know, they all have their place. And I find it can be confusing, particularly to students, to try to line up professions in order of virtue. I mean, there's some things that are explicitly parasitic that I don't think they should do, and they're not going to do anyway. But I think the sharp distinction that's become fashionable in recent years is an error.
But I do have to add one point about that nurse story, because I think you'll appreciate it. It's really where your view, two different contrasting views of the world come together, as of course you point out, they often do. It's not just one thing. It's a couple of things are going on there. I was talking to this nurse about the challenges of doing a good job, because it can be a very boring job, and then all of a sudden it's unbelievably intense. And at one point he said to me, and at this point my brother and sister and mom had all been in the room for hours over a course of 3 or 4 days. He said, he conceded that, he said, you know, it really helps to have family here with the patient. And I thought he was going to say, because, you know, it helps them sustain their morale. He said, I think it makes us do a better job. And I thought, of course, of Adam Smith's Impartial Spectator. Yeah. It's like we're the actual spectator watching him. And he said, this was a great thing. He said, it shouldn't be that way. And he's right, of course. It should be that you're equally motivated whether no one's watching. But as human beings, we sometimes fall short. He said, it shouldn't be that way, but sometimes it is.
Yeah. And, you know, the internet didn't destroy offices. People don't all work from their bedrooms. They want to come together and in a social environment and solve problems together.
Yeah, I love to say that there are three things we do together. We do things through government. I don't really think of that as together, but I know many of my listeners do, and you're entitled to that viewpoint. I'm skeptical about it, but okay. We do things through the voting process, certainly, and through the democratic process. We do things for profit, for money, where we work in teams to create new products, services, hire, invest, et cetera. But we also do things for love, for caring, for meaning, for the sport of it, where we voluntarily, what is called civil society, work together to achieve something that doesn't have a bottom line necessarily. So I hate this business versus government as the two ways to solve problems, or, you know, government, which is supposedly, you know, altruistic, versus business, which is grasping. Business is often not grasping. Government's not always altruistic. And there's this third thing called philanthropy or charity or foundation work that is different.
Yeah. I mean, I have my dichotomy is different. Sometimes we do things because they're better than other things. It's best to satisfy our preference. Sometimes it's not. And
meaning sometimes?
Sometimes it's just for itself. Sometimes it's an altruistic gesture that isn't better than the other gestures that we might have engaged in at this moment. The way that we organize ourselves through time, I argue, is not the kind of thing that lends itself to preferences. That some of the argument for that is a bit technical, but not every kind of choice has to be intermediated through the notion that it's better than other things. It can be just, again, at each moment we encounter a challenge, we engage with it. Then when that one's over, we find a new one that may or may not necessarily the best one, but just the one that we latch onto in a human way at that moment. And then the third is our commitment to our beliefs, that, you know, evidence may come to confront our beliefs, and there are moments where we could change our beliefs and become a new person. But why should I change my beliefs to gratify the new person that I might become after I alter them? And, you know, of course, a reasonable, responsible person is open to the data, but they're not always changing. They keep a consistent identity as time passes. So we Keynes said that, when the data changes, I change my beliefs. What do you do, sir? He actually did say that, because I referred to it in the book, and I had to do a lot of research to see if there's evidence. He didn't say it in print, but there are two people who have knowledge of him saying that. One was Paul Samuelson. But he was no different than anybody else. That was just a rhetorical device he had to try to beat people into submission. Everybody keeps their, we modify our beliefs. The data comes. Some every once in a while we'll have a revelation and we'll change radically. But our beliefs are not always for sale at some price. If it turns out that some new idea or some new belief might be more useful, they're not just instruments to help us get ahead. So in those three areas, belief and identity, altruistic gestures. Not to say that all altruism is for itself, but some of it is, I argue. And then the third is the way we engage with time. It's not always imagining current self and future incarnations of ourself that are all stretched out across a utility function, and then we're trading off on all those different future selves, one for the other, in the optimizing way, and then trying to stick on a path that will be time consistent, or then if the path isn't time consistent, worrying that we have a pathological relationship with time and we better get ourselves sorted out because we're not optimizing on behalf of our current and future, all future incarnations of ourselves. That is the standard economic model and why we've gravitated to this. Well, it's the only one that fits with rational choice, but I don't think it's what we do.
Yeah, and it's mathematically attractive, which I think is one of the reasons it gets play. I think there's a...
I think that's the only reason.
Yeah, could be. I'm trying to be generous. It raises an interesting question, I think, I feel that people are much more, what's the right word, analytical is not the right word, but I'll try it. People are much, young people especially, are much more analytical about their future, I feel, than they have been in the past. Let's say, certainly than, say, the 16th century. A young person today is often encouraged to have a career arc. And they get they're bombarded through websites and teaching and other things that say, you know, get a mentor, have a plan, don't just flit about. And I think that's it's not horrible advice, but I think the source of that advice is this imagined rational path that you want to find yourself on. You just need to get on that yellow brick road. And if you do enough reading and take some exams about yourself and learn about yourself, you'll figure out what the right yellow brick road is for you. And I think that's it's an attempt to graft, say, analytical physics, which talks about where a projectile is going to land, with human action, which is just not the same. In other words, we should tell young people, figure out where you want to be in 25 years and then figure out the steps it takes to get there. And I think that's really bad advice.
I give them the opposite advice. I have students who come to me for advice quite often, and they come with that same view. And you know, I say, would I be better off as a doing renewable development in the developing world, or should I be go to investment bank? I said, well, these two options in front of you right now. They say, no. I said, well, come back to me when you've got both jobs. I said, you know, I've had a satisfying career in business and finance, and I never plotted more than one step ahead. And I have lots of friends, some of them are classmates of ours, who the same way. And I planned to be an academic and full time, and it didn't turn out that way. But none of it was planned more than, you know, a very short period of time ahead. And then if I were you, I wouldn't worry too much about it. And then they also talk about wanting to engage in networking. And I'll say, you know, when I was your age, if you called somebody a networker, it was an insult. Yeah. And now you talk about this as something. I would also advise you not to go around trying to use all your human relations as instruments to try to help you get ahead, because I think you'll actually be happier and more satisfied that way. And then when, as I mentioned earlier, when they talk about their desire to want to be a good person, I had the conversation with my own children, particularly my daughter, when she graduated from school and was concerned about these issues. I used an example from a Woody Allen movie when you could still invoke Woody Allen, and I forget which one it is, but he encounters these super smart aliens who would have, I think, 1600 IQ in human terms. And he
sounds like Sleeper, but it might not be.
Yeah, I don't think it is. He might be Radio Days, but he says to them, you know, maybe I've wasted my life. Maybe I should have been a missionary. Maybe I should have worked with the blind. And they say to him, I don't think you're the missionary type. You're a comedian. You want to help people? Tell funnier jokes. Yeah. And if I can just put, I think my job is to, in these sessions, when students come to me, first I try to put them at ease, not to make these plans, because the plans are not going to work out anyway. They should just calm down. And then the other thing I always do is I ask them, what do your parents think you should do? And then I basically echo what the parents say, because I figure if my kids went to see somebody else, I'd want them, and the parents know them best, and the parents sent them there to Columbia. Those are my two contributions.
I'm a little skeptical of that. I think one of the challenges I think some parents have is that what they want for their kids is often what they want for themselves to have their kids do, and not always.
I at least want to respect that.
Yeah,
because I wouldn't want some random professor giving strong advice to my kids without at least thinking about it.
Fair enough. But I want to go back to one thing you just said, which is I think it's the thing that resonates the most with me, and I think it's one of the hardest things for not just young people but every human being, is, and it again highlights the difference between this, what I would call the economics view of the world, which is that in the economics view of the world, everything is an instrument for your satisfaction. Everything. The goods you buy, the work you do, the et cetera, it's all about it goes into this black box called the utility function, and it outputs happiness, utils, as it's called. And I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding, not just of how people actually behave, because I don't think they behave that way, which is part of what your point is, but I also think it's not a good way to behave. And I think the economist's conflation of rational with good is a terrible mistake.
Well, I think it's a depraved way for us to conceive of ourselves.
Exactly.
And to think, because, you know, economists call the representative individual in their model an agent.
Yeah.
But in fact, they have no agency whatsoever. They're just a passive conduit for optimizing these desires which they inherit. There's this so-called pseudo-rational view of human behavior leads to kind of, as Keynes said, a superficiality of judgment and of feeling. And I find this twofold notion to be somewhat therapeutic. So I can experience the human side of things, as we've discussed, without giving up the power of rational choice to understand markets and behavior.
Before we go on, did you talk about Nietzsche? I mean, I don't get to talk about Nietzsche much on this program.
No.
So I'd like to hear, which is related to this issue of challenges.
Yeah. I ended up de-emphasizing Nietzsche a bit in the book. I wrote a paper called Nietzsche and the Economics of Coming in 2000. Becoming.
Yeah.
In 2009 and 2008. And then my editor, who's now at Yale, found out about it. Actually, Rehan Salam read the article, and he was writing for the National Review at the time and kept writing about my article, seeing everything through the lens of overcoming authentic obstacles. And then,
which is Nietzschean.
Yeah. And then this notion of not constantly reevaluating through time is Nietzschean. And then another contribution that I got this from Nietzsche, but it turns out it was in Schopenhauer and Hume before Nietzsche, so I don't attribute it to him in the book, but that this is often obscure to us. We think we act with a purpose, but we invent one after the fact. We rationalize. Rationalize is actually a beautiful word for this purpose. That so we both, when actions are just because, we can invent something to say why it was good. You know, and rational choice gives you license to do that. If, my wife tells me to pick up some milk on the way home, and I say, well, it was optimal, it's better for me to go out later, and then I'll get the milk and I'll have it in time. And she'll say, well, did you think of that at the time? Or did you just forget? But because in rational choice, you don't have to always bring everything to your consciousness. You can say, well, this was the reason I didn't go to the store to get the milk, because it was better to go out later and get several other things at the same time. Gestures, you can just do something that's altruistic that isn't better in any sense. And maybe you can tell yourself, I'll get karma, some Western notion of karma come out of this, or what goes around comes around, as a way of justifying an action that doesn't require a justification, it doesn't have one. Or, if you come up with some evidence that goes against that doesn't fit with any of your beliefs, and you want to dismiss the expert, they're on the take. Or the expert doesn't see something that's obvious to me, even though they know so much more than I do. We're very good at dismissing beliefs that don't fit with the constellation of our pre-existing beliefs. Nietzsche was quite clear on that, we act spontaneously and then tell ourselves a story afterwards. You know, and he used the metaphor of dance, as you did, to describe, and music.
Tell me. What does he say?
Ooh. And thus folks
too
are
hard a question.
It's too hard a question on the spot, Russ.
Okay, sorry about that. But he does talk about dance, which is great.
He does, as and you know, I wanted to call the book for a long time Economics of Becoming. And I was told by everybody that that's becoming what? That's a terrible title. Then Michelle Obama calls her book Becoming, and everybody loves it. So, well, it's her idea. Becoming is great. But what I thought of it.
Maybe a different kind of space there. For,
yeah, but the notion of becoming is that you never get there, that it's always action that takes place through time without necessarily a destination.
Yeah. In the book, you talk about an example of the so-called Chicago school of thinking about the world. And we're both raised in that language and that style. And it was a great deal of fun, by the way, that learning how to apply the rationality principle and the way markets have feedback loops. And we have a really nice example in there of green beans. So talk about how a Chicago economist looks at green beans.
Yeah, we went, there was a in the A&P in Hyde Park, there were...
That's a grocery store.
Grocery store. Yes. It was suggested that I change it to Kroger's in the book, that it would be easier for people to understand. But it wasn't a Kroger's, it was an A&P. Yeah. And if I changed it to Kroger's, then I would be a liar. And I want everything in the book to be true. Yeah. So, yes, it was an old-fashioned grocery store. Thank you for pointing that out. Green beans were sold in cartons, in, I guess, cardboard cartons with cellophane on the top with a rubber band around them. And the question is, why don't they just put them in a big bin and let you grab them and put them in your own plastic bag? That would be more economical, be easier for them. And, you know, we'd think about these things and assume that they have to be rational, that everything has to be there for a purpose that we can understand if we work hard enough. And then, well, if they're in a big bin, people will pick out the best ones and they'll use time to do that. And then everyone will search for beans up to the point where the marginal benefit of finding a better bean equals their wage. So low-wage people will come away with better beans, presumably. But everybody who spends their time collecting the best beans will search and waste their time doing that. So they put them in cartons, but they're randomly selected beans in the cartons. Why don't they put the best beans on the top? Well, there the answer is. Rational consumers will notice that they've tried to flatter their bean quality by putting the best ones on the top, and they'll start to discount that knowledge. So the benefit of putting the better beans on the top will be very low, and the store will have to pay the workers to sort the beans and to try to make them look better than they are. So, you know, we would tell stories like that all day long. You remember it. And the notion is if you just keep at it, the world will reveal its unseen order to us, and we've got
it. It's important because a lot of it is true. So even though we're both picking on the rational, optimizing, maximizing, you know, what Deirdre McCluskey calls Max U, view of humanity, is that there is a lot of that going on. And it doesn't come naturally to most people to think that way. So my example of that is I always ask, when I drive carpool or drive kids home from the soccer game or the baseball game when my kids were in high school, I'd ask them, why aren't potato chip bags filled to the top? And the average human being says, because they're taking advantage of you. It looks like it's full. And then, of course, they're making more money that way. And I said, well, if that were true, shouldn't they just have like a crumb at the bottom? And an enormous bag, by the way, a huge bag, not a little small bag, a huge bag. And what's beautiful about these sort of Chicago-style price theory problems is that you can learn something. Now, what you learn may not always be true, but it gives you an insight that you wouldn't have otherwise had. In this case, as listeners now have listened for a long time, one of the reasons they don't fall to the top is that the air itself in the bag forms a form of cushion that protects potato chips and allows them to be shipped over long distances. People aren't stupid. They realize how much air after they've eaten the first bag. They start to realize they're not filled to the top. They know what they're getting. And there's competition among potato chip companies to provide, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that, I think there's an incredible power of that Chicago style of thinking because it lets you see the unseen often. And it lets you sleep better at night because you don't think you're always a victim. A lot of things that look like you're being taken advantage of, actually, it's good for you. You don't realize it.
Yeah, and things like people talk about planned obsolescence. And what is that? I mean, and it would be so – they could always make more money by giving you something that would last longer, that wouldn't go obsolete and charge you more for it. And I mean, yeah, we are – when we're saying that, that Chicago economics isn't the whole thing, I think neither of us would say that it doesn't explain a tremendous amount and keep you from going astray in many areas.
So let me ask you another question about incentives, which is we've implicitly been talking about along the way. I mentioned the nurse who conceded that sometimes he might do a better job, or maybe he's talking about his colleagues. So I don't want to put him on the spot, but he might have been he was saying that when there is the someone in the room who's potentially censuring you or can judge you, you rise to a different level than if you're only doing it on your own. And I want to ask you about what we might call unseen incentives. So again, going back to our Chicago days, there's something we've talked about on the program called the Peltzman effect. The idea if you make something safer, people will be a little more reckless. Now, a lot of people, when they're told that, so for example, you introduce anti-lock brakes or seatbelts or airbags, people will drive a little less carefully. I've talked on the program before about helmets in football. As helmets get better and better, people are more comfortable using their body as a weapon, their head as a weapon in particular, and that actually can lead to worse outcomes, even though any one outcome might be better. There are going to be more of them. Occasionally, they'll be bad. What are your thoughts on how people respond to those sort of hidden incentives? Because non-economists, when we talk like this, they go, well, that's ridiculous. People don't sit around and calculate the percentages and the probabilities. They just drive, because that could be a way of your responses. That's just it's action for itself.
Sure. My answer would be straight down the rational choice line. And there was a suggestion by an economist that for highway safety, you should put a spike in the steering wheel.
Gordon Tullock
is exactly right, yeah.
Drive really carefully.
Yeah. I think there were some ski mountains that had banned helmets because they felt that it made particularly children be more reckless.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's true, and it's one example of the Gordon Tullock effect. But so, yes, if you add helmets, people will be more reckless, but that could mean that everybody is still more safe simply because there's feedback. But it's natural to us because we're used to people trained in economics, as we see the mathematics of it, that you can have feedback and you can have a countervailing effect that limits the initial effect because people are more reckless, but still in the end,
it'd still be beneficial.
Still beneficial for everyone.
I want to ask you about application of this to the investment world. I've argued that some piece, at least I think it's underestimated the importance of, but some piece of the financial crisis of 2008 are the bailouts of the past that encourage people to think as creditors that they would get their money back if they lent it to reckless investments. So that'd be one sort of rational view, Peltzman-ish view of that crisis. A lot of people in that world would say, we never thought about that. We never paid attention to it. They were just in it for the game. And when the music's playing, you have to dance. It had nothing to do with the idea that I'd be bailed out. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I was there. And at the time, I wasn't engaged in subprime lending or the sorts of things that, I did have one misadventure, which I describe with great candor in the book, building an offshore wind farm at the time. Oh, yeah. But look, I think that the crisis was very complicated and that there's a lot of blame to go around, some of which is still very poorly misunderstood to this day. Let's suppose that you had bought the most toxic AAA tranche of subprime mortgages originated off a Lehman Brothers shelf in mid-2006. So they take sale 2000, I happen to know this data, sale 2006-4, which is still going on today. And it was over 50% low documentation mortgages.
And they didn't have full information about the people.
About
they didn't
people
fill out
doing
every form.
It was everything about it was bad. And it was about there, and still in the end, because investors are going to get about 90% of their principal back, over 90%. In the end, you would say, because someone could say, well, they got bailed out by the government, and that's why they didn't see the full sting of their reckless behavior. You know, I believe that a lot of people who are involved in this thought that house prices could not go down because they hadn't gone down in the past, and they genuinely believe that, and that would bail out a lot of poor underwriting. There was kinds of maturity transformation and structured investment vehicles that, looking back on it, was just terribly reckless. But you had the rating agencies promoting all this with their very impressive track records outside of structured finance. And then they believed their models. It was an overstep of financial engineering. It was a belief in this abstraction that was, you know, I watched it happen in my career when we could start, when we first started being able to price complex derivatives and value them on models. I felt like we're really getting away with something here. This is really, felt like we're pushing, then you get used to it. And, but, you know, and then judgment starts to become de-emphasized in large financial institutions because it can't be passed easily up and down the chain. It's not best practices all the time. There's so many things that went on there. And, you know, it's not just subprime mortgages. There were subprime mortgages in the UK, Netherlands, that performed, and they were securitized too. So the simple folk narrative that because they were selling these mortgages to securitizations and therefore they would never be responsible for them, it's just wrong. Mortgages that banks kept for themselves performed more poorly than the ones that they sold into asset-backed securities because at least there was some level of scrutiny by investors and rating agencies. So the banks themselves were hanging on to mortgages that were quite poor. And so I think securitization had a role in this, but not the central role that people give it. You know, I don't know anybody who, I didn't encounter anybody at the time who would say cynical things about, oh, this is going to blow up, but the government will bail us out. I mean, maybe that's not what you're suggesting.
Not what I'm suggesting, because although there is a story of the in my book on this, that the in England when the Bank of England asked some bankers, you know, why their risk models only went so far, why they didn't look at more riskier opportunities or riskier scenarios. He said people looked down at their shoes and didn't really want to answer. And he said, well, you know, what's going on? He said, well, we figure if it gets like that, we don't have to worry about it because you'll bail us out. Now, my point, which I'm pressing you on a little bit, is the reason I brought up the Peltzman effect. We would not argue that a football player makes a rational calculation of how fast to run and how much to put his head down. And yet, I believe, and I think you believe, that they are affected by some of these incentives, like the seatbelt in the driver's case, et cetera. So I'm asking, even though the people in the bank might not have said it, after decades of not having to worry about spending their own money and being in a world where the worst case scenario wasn't so bad because things did get bailed out, it may have affected behavior.
I just make 2 points about that. First, you know, the government probably made close to $1 trillion on the so-called bailout. I think people should keep that in mind. I'm not so sure.
I don't agree with that. But go ahead. Some estimates are that they made money. That others say it's not so. As in fact, there's a new paper out on. I'll try to find it.
I think the GM bailout lost money, but the TARP, the TALF, certainly the Fed has made a fortune. The bailout of government-sponsored entities, or I should say, the conservatorship
Fannie
of those,
Freddie, yeah.
that's been hugely lucrative. And then all the fines. I'm adding the fines into my estimate. Something more like last time I tallied it up. I don't care one way or the other. I just want to know what's true. It was over $700 billion that the government has made. So I think it's real money. It's certainly a mistake to say that the government's that the public has suffered in the end from the bailout, from the cost of the bailout.
Oh, but I don't think that's the right calculus, right? You don't want to look at the tax because it's the incentive effect on prudent investing is disastrous.
No, I understand, which is why banks submit themselves to regulation, because there always has to be. I mean, look at the bailout of the money market funds, okay? In September 16th, that was when primary reserves was prepared to break the buck, because there was very little Lehman commercial paper, but they happened to have it.
Breaking the buck meaning?
That they were going to pay back 98 cents
instead of
$1 instead of 100.
Yeah.
So the Treasury did the only thing they could do. They gave an emergency, they dropped everything else, and they gave an emergency voluntary guarantee to all money market funds for one or two, it was one basis point at the time. But each fund was made an offer they couldn't refuse, and they paid one basis point for a blanket guarantee from the Treasury. This was about a $3 trillion industry at the time that would have imploded, and it shouldn't have been. And these were like banks with no capital that
right.
money market funds
yeah.
were. And so gradually they've been, as of last year, the regulation has been phased in, so this won't happen again.
But I'm going to push back on this a little bit just to go one more level down into the weeds, then we'll come back to your book, which is, because I thought a lot about that primary reserve story. My question at the time was, or not at the time because I didn't understand it, but a couple of years later when I started looking at it, was what was a money market fund doing holding Lehman paper, especially after Bear Stearns, which had a very similar balance sheet to Lehman, had imploded. And after Bear Stearns got rescued and all their creditors were made whole, so it made sense to hold Lehman because you make a good return.
Yeah. Yeah, and also the SEC allowed it, which it wouldn't allow today.
That's interesting.
There are strict limits on concentration limits and limits based on ratings.
Okay, so let's shift gears. I want to talk about the paradox of choice, which is something that's always bothered me, Barry Schwartz's thesis. What's your take? Explain what that thesis is and your take on it.
Yeah. The argument, as I understand it, is that people are overwhelmed by an abundance of choice. The kind of prototypical experiment is to go into a – they sent researchers disguised as merchants into a store, and they would offer 24 different types of jam, and then people didn't buy them, and then they would offer them a smaller number, and they would four or something like that, and then they would buy them, which proves that if you give people a dizzying array of choice, that somehow you confuse them, you upset them, and
paralyze.
And you shouldn't do it. That's the lesson. I think there are several things wrong with this. First of all, this is a contrived experiment. I think that real stores with real money on the line know what kind of choice their customers would like. And some, I think if you offered only one type of toothpaste, people would. I think probably all types of toothpaste are basically the same as far as I'm concerned.
Really similar.
Wouldn't bother me, but a lot of people would be concerned about it. They'd be distressed about it. It'd be like the Soviet Union. Here we are.
And they'd prefer going to a store that had 10.
Yeah, even though they took the one that the other store had.
Not 1,000. If a toothpaste are you that had 1,000 choices probably wouldn't attract too many customers, but maybe, who knows?
If it did, no, I think there wouldn't, because if there were such a, if people wanted it.
It would exist.
It would exist.
That's the Chicago side of you, Richard.
And I give an example in the book of menus from the late 19th century that had huge arrays of choice, much more than anybody could need. Smaller numbers of, you don't have to choose between 24 vegetables every time you go out to eat. A smaller number would span the space of what people want. Any dietary restrictions, any momentary preferences. But somehow people, the act of, in our view of neoclassical economics, choice is passive. But taking the choice itself matters to people. And they want to be able to take the menu and to pick and to say, yes, this and not that. And I also, you know, the theory that Herbert Simons had of satisficing, that people will maybe not pick the same thing every time, that they'll that their choices are not perfectly consistent because they don't have enough brain power to be able to sort through all the different options. I think on the contrary, maybe they rationally serve up the different choices that would be good enough, approximately as good. And then they want to exercise their will. They want to make a choice. They want to be act on the world and have a bit of agency and say, I'll pick this one. I was reading a paper coming down on the train to see you from the journal Political Economy that was trying to explain a related paradox that you ask people preferences, questions over which of three different lotteries they prefer, where you can get this amount of money with this probability and this amount with that probability. And they ask lots of different, they present them, do you want this one or that one? Okay, do you want this one or that one? And then they find, it's in the literature, that people will change their minds, that if you ask them the same question three times, they'll give different answers. And one theory is that they don't have a bounded rationality. And another is some exotic notion of them wanting to create a portfolio of choices. But maybe people just want to, you know, there's very little money involved, a few cents. And maybe they're not paying close attention. It's another theory. But they just want to choose. They just want to say, I'm picking this one, and that's who I am, and that's what I'm going to do. And I think to judge that is irrational. Or if we find that we make choices, sometimes make one choice and sometimes make a different one, to beat ourselves up over it is, I don't think we have to do that.
You're talking about the paradox of choice, and one thing that's to give it its due, Barry Schwartz's story is in our models that we were taught as neoclassical economics, nobody has anguish over a decision. You might if you didn't have full information, but the real anguish of a decision is that future you may not be happy with the decision, and that weighs on a human being, and that doesn't fit in our world. So,
yeah, but people want to have that experience nonetheless, or we wouldn't offer it. I mean,
for sure.
If you want to have a store that offers only one kind of thing, you can try that. I mean, there
7-Eleven is such a store for convenience. You have retailing options for when you don't want to make a big choice, or when you're in a hurry, or for when you're on the road, or whatever it is. Don't have good information. Rely on a brand name. We understand.
Because the stores, if you offer too much choice, the store will be bigger. And
yeah,
you won't
rents
be
are high.
Yeah.
Gerd Gigerenzer on the show recently talking about the power of intuition and hunches. And, you know, when he talks about heuristic rules of thumb, contrasting with more analytical, say, regression-based decision tools or tools like value at risk for dealing with uncertainty. And he argues that, you know, somewhat convincingly to me, because that's by nature to be skeptical as other models, that sometimes intuition can outperform these more analytical methods. And it raises the question, which, of course, is that you can also fool yourself thinking you have too much intuition. You're really good at hunches. You forget all the times your intuition led you astray, got you to invest in bad things. In investing in particular, what are your thoughts on the role of hunches and intuition? You talk a lot about it in the book, that there comes a time when you just have to make a leap, and that a lot of the best decisions are not analytical.
Right. I like to use the term judgment. Hunches sounds careless with other people's money.
Yeah.
I think that if you could boil down a set of decisions that are going to produce profits into rules, somebody would have arbitraged it away already. And that the opportunity to make money comes from things that are unique, that where their essential qualities haven't happened before. A Hayekian personal knowledge that can't be easily abstracted and transmitted to a central authority. He used it to talk about forms of government. My interest is in making specific investments. He talked about the kind of knowledge of the man on the spot of time and place and specifics that may look like something else but differs in some way that he notices. And if he could fully articulate it and explain why he deviates from the rule this time and not other times, well, then it's just another rule. And that there is a moment where one has to apply, well, we can, we'll use Adam Smith's term, which I love, of anxious vigilance. Yeah. And I love the anticipation of anxiety, because the anticipation of the way philosophers or Kierkegaard would use anxiety and existentialists, because anxiety comes from the isolation that you feel when you can't draw on any set of fixed rules, or there are several sets of fixed rules and there's equally good reason for choosing between them. A manager can't delegate anxious vigilance all the way down the line because he has to confront it. It's the same thing for an investor. There are moments where anxious vigilance has to take over. It should be informed by experience and judgment and analysis. I'm not suggesting that we just scratch our chin and decide what to do, but there comes a moment where I think in any investment that's dealing with things that are inherently new, that only happen once, where it's going to be hard to argue that it's necessarily better than something else, but just to say, well, I'm going to do it and I've been entrusted with this responsibility and I'm going to do this and not that. And here are my various reasons, but the reasons are not, I could also give you reasons for doing something else. And I think a really important challenge in institutional investing is how to harness roles of judgment and then do this inside of an organization that has corporate governance. We're not Each person can't have the same wisdom and judgment that the ultimate decision maker is invoking.
So we both publish books. You know, an editor's intuition about whether a book is going to be successful, an editor who's got her own line of books, is different than an editor within a large, modern, accountant-driven, bottom-line-affected corporate company where you've got to get approval up the line, in which case, if you're not careful, you start thinking about, I don't want to publish the best books. I want to publish the books that I know that the committee will sign off on. And that phenomenon, I also think about it in sports. If I can come back to the Patriots for a minute, you know, Bill Belichick at a famous moment in the Super Bowl decided not to call a timeout. Everyone else thought it was a horrible mistake in that moment. I was screaming at the TV. The clock was ticking down. Patriots are about to fall behind. We're going to need the time to get back ahead. And when asked later why he didn't call a timeout, he claimed to have a reason. He said, I looked over at the other sideline. They looked a little confused. I thought I wasn't going to help them. By the way, and he's got a headset on. His assistant coaches are yelling, do you want a timeout? Don't you want, you know? And he just said, and you can see him on camera because we've got the video of him just calmly doing nothing. And you know, one possibility in that situation is you just got lucky. You easily could have lost the game. And I'm curious how you think about that in that investment context. Do you think there are people with great judgment or are they just lucky?
Oh, I think luck has oh so much to do with it. In my own firm, I can point to moments where if the dice had rolled the wrong way, it would have pushed us over, would have put it as a business, as not the investments themselves, but as an investment manager, we wouldn't have been able to survive. And, you know, I look at people who did survive and shake my head and wonder why. And now I know, it's because they were lucky. And this notion that you make your own luck, I mean, yeah, I think anybody with any who's been around at all and has some self awareness knows that you should just be very fortunate for the luck that you have, because there's a heavy.
You weren't in the back room manufacturing the luck so that when it.
No. And this is not some false humility. I know that it's true. In terms of football calls, I say one thing on behalf of Rational Choice. When I was at Chicago, the people used to always say they ought to go for it on fourth down more often instead of punting. It would be like—
It's been proven, by the way, in many formal studies.
In formal studies. Yeah. And it was frustrating.
Coaches are irrational, obviously.
Coaches would, you know, they'd be on the opponent's 40-yard line or on the 50-yard line. It's early in the game. It's fourth and one, fourth and two, and they punt. Well, I've noticed in the last 5 or 7 years, I'm not expert on this, but I have the strong impression that many more teams go for it on fourth down. So eventually, the economists seem to be winning out on this one.
But I think the economists are naive, as they often are in these situations where they talk about what's rational or irrational, in that the incentives facing the coach are very peculiar. I just want to mention this one thing I think is often forgotten. And I've talked about sports in the past, and people would say, well, if competition is so powerful, why do coaches make stupid decisions? It's a very peculiar competitive environment. If you want to be a head coach in the NFL, there are 32 slots. I think I have the number right. There's 32. That's it. There are no more. It's not like, oh, well, if it's a good year, there'll be 35 or 50. If it's a great year and only 17 a different year, it's only 32 slots. Hard to get those slots. It's not easy to figure out who's a great head coach. We can tell that. That's easily shown that it's not easily shown. And so there can be a conservatism that is totally rational to preserve your job in the face of an ex post decision by an irrational or emotional owner who says, you obviously made a mistake. Why'd you go for it on fourth down? And groupthink is going to be the rational choice under certain situations. Right. And by the way, that's true in the financial sector too, where what looks like a horrible decision, if everyone else is doing it, looks okay and you can defend yourself.
Yeah. And that's why in a financial world, I think the relationship between the coach and the owner is
in the football world.
In the football world.
Yeah.
Is key. And the idea that somehow institutional investors allocate their money to a manager and wait to see what happens is also wrong. The connection that a manager has to the investor and is central to the ability to deploy judgment. I can tell a story about that. That's from my book.
Go ahead.
Yeah. There's a book about the greatest trade ever. It's when a hedge fund manager shorted subprime mortgages. But I believe the greatest trade ever was when Joseph in the Bible.
I was going to ask you about that, so I'm glad you brought it up. Go ahead.
Interpreted the dream of Pharaoh. Joseph was acting on inside information of the highest order, revelation directly from God.
Possibly. It was a dream, but he took it as prophetic.
Right. Yeah. And the dream that, you know, there are two dreams, but of seven fat calves followed by seven thin cows, and same thing with grains of wheat. And Pharaoh asked Joseph to interpret the dream, and Joseph said, well, there's going to be 7 years of drought followed by 7 years of famine. Seven years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine from a drought. And so Pharaoh said, well, what should I do? And Joseph says, you should get a wise and discerning man to help you acquire grain. Now, why wise and discerning?
In the good years.
Yeah, in the good years to hoard grain. Why wise and discerning? Why not somebody who's skilled at logistics or has done big projects before? And the answer becomes quite clear. 7 years is a long time to wear a bad trade, to hold on to the grain when the sun is shining and the crops are plentiful and you're still buying this up and people have to consume less in the good years. And they wonder why. Joseph himself is going to wonder, well, did I misinterpret the dream? Were there hidden conditions? You know, he had a track record. He had predicted the outcome for the baker and the cupbearer while he was in prison. But, you know, track records come and go. And he'd also predicted that he was going to reign over his brothers, and that hadn't yet come to pass. So, you know, some of it was still unknown. Yet they were able to hang on to this for this entire time because of the wisdom and you know, to put on. There are many times in business where you can, you know, let's say you buy a stock because it's undervalued by 30%. Well, at some point it was undervalued by 15%, and then it just fell another 15%. And it might fall further and become even more undervalued. And the relationship between the person making that decision, and everyone has a provisional and temporary hold on their money at some level, no matter what you think. And to be able to to hang on under adversity. Everyone has that in limited doses. And the closer someone is to their investor, the wiser their investor is, the wiser they are, their ability they have to explain it, to get more money if something needs it, but if it's not an act of desperation or delusion, but it actually genuinely requires it. Those are all very human things, but I think that's much more important in finance than the next, advance in financial engineering. And those are matters that are pretty much neglected because they're very hard to talk about. But I think I think it matters for the integrity of the financial system to have organizations that don't have to sell off when things turn against them, if there's good reason for holding on. All those are issues that I want to bring up in my book, I think institutions are healthier if they think about them.
I really love that insight into the Joseph story, partly because in the book of Genesis, when it tells that story, it kind of abstracts from that. It just sort of says, and he bought up a lot of grain, and then when the famine came, he sold it off. I mean, when the famine came, he could sell it and feed the people and make a killing for the Pharaoh. It's a frightening moment of central planning, actually, but turned out well for Pharaoh and Joseph. But what the story doesn't illuminate, which you do, is to think about what day-to-day that was like. And I think it's an incredible example of your anxious vigilance. I mean, can you imagine? Every day it's looking better and brighter, and the crops keep coming in, and it's like, what are you doing hoarding grain in the good times? You're an idiot.
Yeah, and when he was and Joseph was married to the daughter of a high priest, he was given a special wardrobe and he was told that he was
in a victory parade when he got hired.
Yeah, that's
with
right.
A special vehicle, I think, in a big chariot.
That's like right, and he's second only to Pharaoh. How come a grain buyer needs to? And you could almost say the same thing about traders in banks, that they're treated as a wizard class that possesses that helps them hang on and do their job. And it is discussed. This is in the Talmud, as I understand it. After 2 years, the famine ended early because Jacob gave his blessing to Pharaoh. So even there always are hidden conditions and arbitrary changes that you can't anticipate. Yeah. So it didn't go 7 years.
Yeah, but 2 years is still plenty. And I like the insight that his own self-confidence would be shaken by the could have been shaken by the realization that his dream about his brothers didn't come true. Of course, it would come true eventually, but he didn't know that at the time. And as you say, the fact that a couple of his other dreams he interpreted correctly could be just luck. And it's a very small sample, too.
Yeah.
So it's a great insight. An argument I get into with some people is to whether people can be altruistic. They say, there's no such thing as true altruism because you're either doing it because it makes you feel good to help other people or because it's good for your reputation. What's your take on altruism and why people do what at least look like selfless acts?
Yeah. My take is it's complicated, but it's not so complicated that we can't bear down on it and try to understand it. And I think the distinction between the purposeful and the for itself can be quite useful to gain insights. The comment that, well, it's not genuine altruism because we only do things because if we didn't want to do them, we wouldn't do them. I guess at some level of generality, that's true, but it's not telling us very much. I break it down into five pieces. There's selfish altruism. Sure, sometimes we may do a favor for someone in anticipation of a future favor or because it signals virtue. You can't deny that exists. If it's just virtue signaling, then everybody would know that it was a ruse and it wouldn't work. So there has to be a little more to it than that. But I think it's not defensible to say that's all there is. You could say altruism is just exhibiting good manners and conforming to social norms. We put a price on that. I'll hold the door for somebody most of the time, but if I'm in a big hurry, I won't. And I have a little cost to it. And then that's at one extreme where we have a very loose connection to someone else. then
and those are somewhat purposeful.
Oh yeah, those are clearly purposeful. And then the opposite extreme, which you know about as a Chicago student and a Becker student, is when we have very intense care for someone and their utility becomes, their well-being becomes an argument into our own utility function. Where Gary Becker used as the example a mother or child, where it's very strong and the mother will balance her own consumption, her own benefits with her child and trade them off. And of course, you know, mother may think in terms of caring only about the child, but she doesn't consume zero and she doesn't have zero fulfillment away from the child ordinarily if she's living a healthy life. But the trade-off between the two will be as a common unit. And there's another nice example that Gary gives of the rotten kid, that even if one person in the unit is completely selfish and doesn't care about the other, they'll still act to maximize the well-being of the household, because if they engage in a destructive act where the benefit to the rotten child is lower than the cost to the mother or the rest of the family, household wealth goes down. And one of the objectives of the household is the well-being of the rotten child, and the well-being and the rotten child's well-being will go down as well. So I call that in my book, observed care altruism, when someone has a very genuine care and they act as a single unit and it becomes completely purposeful. Now, some care may be unobserved. We would call a corner solution, where there's, you know, I care about the Yankees. Maybe, I don't know how you don't. You don't.
That's okay.
Okay, we can take opposite views on this. I would, it wasn't their pitching that cost them in the end, but I would like to see them improve their pitching. I would, if no one was looking, I would give a little bit of money to improve the Yankees' pitching. And if no one ever knew, and I was never even sure that that's what happened, some sort of magical thing. But obviously, I don't make voluntary contributions to the Yankees to help them improve because I don't care enough.
Or the free rider problem. If you made that contribution, come Chicago on you. If you made that contribution, then maybe the owners would spend less. And
there's that too.
Yeah.
But in this thought experiment, the owners the owners don't respond to what I'm doing. The fair point. But just because I don't do anything about it doesn't mean I don't care. And you could, the way to make that statement empirically meaningful, if there's some mechanism where I could give a small amount and it could be amplified, then I would, I'd like to see the Hudson River be cleaner. I would give a certain amount of money if it were magnified. And I'd like to see the Nile be cleaner. I care less about the Nile than I do about the Hudson, but I don't give any money to either of them.
But people do.
People do.
Yeah, maybe care more than you do, or
whatever. Money to other things. Yeah. I just picked two things that I don't give money to as an example. And I'm grateful to the people who do. But if someone were to say, well, you obviously don't care because you haven't done anything about it, I would say, on the contrary, I just care a little bit and I care about other things more, not enough to actually give anything. So I think all three of those, selfish altruism, social norms, and care altruism, where the well-being of something else enters into our own utility, are all squarely purposeful. But I don't think I think there's more to it than that. Sometimes we'll make an altruistic gesture that isn't the best one, just because someone is in front of us. We're a human being. An example that I still puzzle over is, you know, in the subway. It happened to me just the other day. Someone was holding a door in a crowded train for a stranger. And you figure you save maybe at most 5 minutes for one stranger, and you cost 10 seconds, 300 people. It's a deadweight loss of 45 minutes. So if you're trying to benefit society in some coherent way, you'll just let the door slam shut, assuming you don't know the person. So why? I used to think that the person was confused. They couldn't make the calculation
not as smart as you are. They don't realize.
They haven't gone to University of Chicago, and they just their mind is just a big mush, and they should be rational, but in this one instance, they're not. And over time, I've come to believe that I personally would make the calculation, by the way. I'd let the door slam shut because I don't want to cause all those other people to wait.
But, and you're aware of it in a way that this other person might not
how
be.
Do maybe, I, no how, way how do I know?
Yeah.
But you know, the one person, the single concrete individual who's standing in front of them, who's going to be left to wait for the next train, maybe can't be compared in some large... If they're not out to be... if it's not an exercise in maximizing social welfare, but the person is thinking of something else. And there's one random person they want to help out, and they're willing to let other people bear the cost. I feel I can respect that. It's a human gesture. One that I've also talked about that I think is easy for people, it was transformative for me to have this insight, is in the parable of the Good Samaritan. Okay. He's walking down the road on his way to Jerusalem. It's actually not clear where he came from. Not necessarily from Samaria, on research, but we know where he's headed. And he sees a man beaten on the road. Okay, he goes and stops to see if he's alive or dead, gets him on his feet. Okay, completely normal. This guy has social norms that he follows. And it's what many people would do. But then he decides to take him to the inn, pay the innkeeper to look after him, gives him advice. There's nothing special about this one guy. Why lavish all this attention on just one random man? There's no evidence that he's got special qualities. And maybe he's thinking he can tell the story later and be famous throughout the ages. But he's famous also He's famous for not optimizing. He could help the next person who's beaten rather than this extravagant gesture towards this one person. Is he caught up in a cognitive bias, the salience bias of the one person who's in front of him overtakes him? And I don't think that's the case, because if you explain to him that he could do a better job by helping three people instead of this two people who are badly in need instead of this one, that he could actually do more good, he doesn't care. That's not the calculation he's making. There's this one person, the single individual that is at hand, and that's what he's doing now. And there's no argument that he can make or needs to make in order to be able to do this.
Well, the person standing outside the subway or the bus or whatever it is waiting to get on, and you hold the door for him, no extra delaying the other people, I think there's a Hayekian knowledge issue there that is easily neglected, which is, you don't see the face of that person who's waiting outside. If you saw the face of the person and you saw the desperation, you might realize that them making this train actually is enormously important. You might correctly discount the extra 20 seconds for those people and suggest that doesn't really add up to the 5 minutes lost to those people. There's a non-comparability there that you hinted at. And I think the point there, which I think is important, is that you know, this utilitarian calculus that somehow, first of all, certainly no one in the moment does that. You're suggesting if you did later reflect on it, you might realize, maybe that wasn't the best thing I could do. But my view is that it's hard to do the right thing. And if you acculturate yourself to responding to desperation, whether it's a person lying in the street or a person waiting for the subway, you're going to be a better human being. It's the kind of human being you want to be. It's not just, I want to be the one who maximizes fill in the blank. It's that I know I am prone to undervaluing the well-being of others. And so I'm going to allow myself rationally to irrationally overweight the look on that person's face, and I'm going to feel good about it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't like to use the term waiting, but waiting in terms of overweighting, not W-E-I-G-H-T. Because it's just for, they did it.
Oh, I agree.
They did
it,
and they can't say why.
Yeah, I don't like the...
They can't say why, but they can just say that they did it, and that's the end of the discussion, yeah. And I can stop there.
And I had this moment, I think I said it to you, but I wrote it up on Twitter, and I think I said it to you before we did this interview, where coming out of an elevator in a parking garage where I'm wheeling the equipment for my interview downtown to go do an interview like this, and a woman holds the door for me. It's a particularly heavy door, and I was thinking... And she ran out. There were two of us alone on the elevator. She ran out, and I thought, oh, she's in a hurry. But then I wondered, is she going to pause and hold the door for me? And she did, and I rolled out all my junk. And I thought that was kind. And she missed the next train, or at least when I got to the platform 3 minutes behind. She ran after that. Once she held the door for me, she took off in higher heels than I was wearing, did her best, hustled to the platform, did not catch a train. And I went up to her, and I said, it was really nice of you to hold the door for me. And she looked at me like, yeah. And I said, you were in a hurry. She said, yeah. And I said, you probably didn't want to hold the door. And she looked at me and said, well, I always hold the door. Yeah. And that's her rule. And it's a good rule. It's doesn't always benefit her, perhaps, but that's her rule.
Yep.
I don't think you talked about did you talk about mercy? Did we get to that?
Yeah, well, mercy is
we're talking about the five kinds of altruism.
Mercy is the for itself. It's the I define mercy as holding open the door, the Good Samaritan. It's an act that's not that it's a for itself act that isn't the best. Each by its nature, mercy can't come out of a formula. It just has to happen, and I see that as essentially for itself. And the fifth kind of in my taxonomy of altruism, which I think is also for itself, I call love altruism, which is just bigger than any other. It would apply to very grand gestures. Maybe you could argue to subsume it in mercy, but I think it needs a place for itself.
Give an example of that.
An example would be a woman sees her husband is drowning in the river. It's a philosopher's example. Does he calculate what's the present value? Does the woman, thinking of saving her husband, calculate what's the present value of services and benefits that I expect to derive from my husband, multiplied by the chance that I'm going to save him, adjusted for the fact that he might save himself without my intervention, and then from that deduct the probability that I'm going to drown, multiplied by the value that I attribute to my own life? A calculation like that strikes us as absurd because it's all subordinate to the fact that this is her husband who she loves. And anything that we would try to add to the analysis would be what the philosopher Bernard Williams called one thought too many. So we can just stop there. She loves her husband. She jumps in to save him.
Gary Becker would not be satisfied with that. But I think, you know, occasionally said, Becker's relentless squeezing of those kind of actions into the calculus of utility maximization he does it in an incredibly artful way. Most people struggle to do that as well. And you write, I thought very provocatively, and some of you have come to, it troubles me, but have come to believe it. You say, you didn't say it's not the quote part yet, but you're talking about what it's like to study economics. You say it accustoms you to a, quote, mechanistic understanding of life. And I think that's true. And I've come to believe, it's a nice note to end on, I've come to believe that that's a mistake, not just analytic. I think it's definitely an analytical mistake. I think a lot of behavior, although can be occasionally predicted by that mechanistic understanding, is not actually understanding what their people are actually doing. They're not making those calculations. That the as-if hypothesis of Milton Friedman is a mistake. But worse than that, that it actually degrades you a little bit and takes away from what is our fundamental humanity and tries to turn us into something more robotic.
Yeah. Look, I don't want to become a heretic here because I know how powerful rational choice is. I do think that we ought to be careful in teaching it, particularly to high school students or wherever we teach it. Because, you know, the extreme case would be Bentham's philosophic calculus, the extreme case of utilitarianism, where you're born into a straitjacket of a certain number of pleasures and pains, and your job in life is to maximize the duration of and magnitude of the intensity of the pleasures minus the pains. And you don't even get to shape your own preferences. And so you have the minimum amount of humanity in that. And I don't know why people, you know, there's a statue of Bentham in London. I don't know what it's doing there, because I think it's just a miserable way to think of your own actions and your own behavior. But accepting that life is twofold, that there are two realms, and to keep the and to realize that there's more to it than just this rational choice, without turning our back on it, I find it to be helpful for me to try to keep measure of humanity while still using rational choice in my daily life.
My guest today has been Richard Robb. His book is Willful. Richard, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Oh, so much fun, Russ. Thanks.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.